This is Westward. Westward is a production of the Dan Patrick Podcast Network and iHeartRadio.
This is Bobby Glanton Smith, and you're listening to Westward, bonus episode one. Westward has been a social experiment in many ways. Paul Cusciari and I truly believe that sports and entertainment are pillars and foundation for a country that's going through a tremendous amount of turmoil right now. And we have endeavored to use this podcast to give people a look inside of a sport that has blossomed and flourished for the last 60 years right here in the city of Los Angeles. So we hope you'll enjoy this special episode of Westward. The Showtime era was accentuated by the presence of Michael Cooper, a wiry forward from New Mexico State who emerged as one of the greatest defenders in the history of the NBA. He played alongside Norm Nixon, Magic Johnson, the captain Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and James Big Game Worthy. In his own words, Michael Cooper. Man, first of all, man, it's really an honor, man, and a privilege to be able to have you come on and talk to us about a very special time in this city and the sport of basketball. And we're going to jump right on into it. You grew up in Pasadena, right?
Yeah, Pasadena, California. My family is originally from New Hebron, Mississippi. He was a big baseball fan, and he actually tried out for the Negro League baseball, and he didn't make it, so the family moved out here to Pasadena. And he was always about team. So he used to preach to us. It was me, and I had like five other cousins. So we had our own little team in the neighborhood. The Butler clan is what they would call us. Always preached team. So he made us watch the Boston Celtics. And he was a big Celtic fan because of Bill Russell, Fats Sanders, players like that. And he wanted to see how Boston played the game. They played with each other. They passed the ball. They played good defense. And so we were always taught to want to be like them. So as I was coming up, my idol was John Havlicek. That's what I wanted to be like. He's a player that did everything, you know, play good defense, good scorer, good rebounder, you know, play multiple positions. So I grew up not necessarily a Boston fan, but admiring the way they play the game because basketball is a team sport.
I wasn't necessarily a Boston fan. By the way, I'm from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, so we got some country going on in the moment, knowing that you're a Mississippi brother, you know what I mean? And did you play other sports in high school?
As I was growing up, we played, like I said, there was a lot of us, six or seven of us, and I had Tom, my uncle, and John used to, whatever sport was going on at that particular season, that's what we would play. Baseball, he wanted us to play baseball, but I tried out for the Pee Wee Baseball, the Little League hardball when I was like 13, and a guy threw a pitch and it hit me in the leg, and I said, nope, that's not for me, because that hurt. So I went to football, and I love to jump, so I like to play wide receiver, and we were at the park one day, and a guy threw the ball, and I jumped up in the air and caught it, and the guy undercut me. Ooh. And next thing I know, everybody was over me saying, Coop, you all right? You all right? And I said, nope, that's not for me. So I played basketball, and basketball wasn't really – I was good. I was always athletic. But it wasn't like a star or anything like that. So I played for the YMCA team and didn't play a lot. And there was this guy named Mr. Kelly. And he was the coach of the team, and he had two sons that played football. So they would have the overlap was like 3 weeks. So for 3 weeks, I would play a lot. But as soon as his sons came, I went to the bench. So my uncle would come and watch, and my cousin, who wasn't that good, started over me, played more than I did. And so one day, my uncle he was like, Michael, you having fun? And I said, you know what, Tom, I'm down. This ain't for me. And he sat me down. He told me, says, Michael, if you enjoy this game, don't ever let anybody take your joy from you, no matter who he is. If you enjoy this game, no matter what, how many minutes you get, because this is going to change. This is for right now. He said, never let them steal your joy. And you know what? That's how I approached it. As a 9th, 10th grader, still probably about 5'10", 5'11", made the varsity, the junior varsity team as an 11th grader, playing under him at Pasadena, and then finally getting to spend a full season with Coach Turgeon. He taught us, that was the first time I realized about, I've always been very religious, but I didn't think religion and basketball went together. Religion is something you did on your own. Basketball is something that was separate. So that's when I learned athletes in action, which is what Coach Turgeon, our coach, was about, and how you could put religion and basketball together. And as a senior, didn't get a lot of scholarships anywhere, and that's when I chose to go to junior college. So I went to Pasadena City College for a year. But as a young person, that's how I developed the game, the fundamental parts of the game. That was in my freshman year at Pasadena City College. I had a coach named Joe Barnes there, and Coach Barnes was all about offense. And my freshman year, we had a decent team, but that summer of my freshman and sophomore year, I grew like 4.5 inches. And that's when, in my sophomore year, is when I was like 6'5", 6'6". And that's when I really learned how to score. I'd always been a good defensive player, good team player. Team to me means together, everyone achieves more, and developed that aspect in high school at Pasadena High School, and then took that to college. But Coach Barnes, he let me go offensively, so that's when I became a better offensive player. And one thing I like to tell kids is, you know, I developed this concept called Coop's 5 D's. They are determination, dedication, desire, discipline, and decision-making. And I tell kids at one point in time, that was my report card in high school, because back then in the day, all you had to do was stay eligible. All you had to do was have a D. I couldn't have no F or no incomplete, just a D. So that is the reason why I didn't get the big-time scholarships coming out of high school, because academically, a lot of people thought that I wouldn't be able to be that true student-athlete. They just thought I was an athlete student. So I learned that concept in my freshman year, and unfortunately, I became academically ineligible. And that's what really opened it up for me, because I realized now that you can't be an athlete student. You have to be a student athlete. So I got myself together academic-wise, became that good player basketball-wise, and my sophomore year, I averaged like 23, 24 points a game at Pasadena City College. And that's when the scholarship started coming in.
I've been told that you had some physical challenges as a child. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
As a young person growing up, when I was about 5 years old, my uncles liked dogs. And we had gotten this dog, and the dog had puppies. And we were told that everybody was going to get their own dog. So when the dog had puppies that morning, everybody was like, the dogs had puppies. So I remember I was in the house. And you know, in the day, my grandmother, how we used to get the big Folger cans, you know, and they would take all the coffee out of them and send them outside, and they would pour the chicken grease and bacon grease and put those on the back porch.
My country.
So I was going out, and I guess the people going out before me had knocked that can over, but they didn't cut the whole top of the can off. They left the top on to where it was like that. Mm-hmm. So as I was going out, the can had flipped on the side, with the top of the can half open, and I slipped on the grease and cut my left knee. So I fell on that and cut my knee. And as a 5-year-old, being super duper skinny, I cut it all the way to the bone, and the can nicked my bone. And I remember I was crying, and I had 102 stitches in my right knee, in my left knee. I'm sorry, left knee. It had been so long, but that was a physical crisis, if you want to say. And if you ever seen that movie Forrest Gump, when the kids are teasing him when he's younger and he had those braces that led into his shoe, And he ran out of them. He was running so hard, he ran out of them. I had one on my left knee exactly like that. Had the straps on it up to my thigh, and I had a shoe. So for about a year, I couldn't walk. And finally, when I started walking is when they put that on. But the one thing I'll never forget about that moment in my life, and my grandmother was praying for me that whole night. I had to stay awake because they didn't want me to catch a blood clot. So she kind of got me up and just made me stand up on the side of the bed. But she was telling me the whole time, Michael, you're a blessed child. You're a blessed child. It's going to be all right. You're a blessed child. Don't worry about this. And, you know, truly I was in her eyes, and I became that. But I overcame that. But that was very traumatic for me. Got 102 stitches. Doctor said I'd never walk again. And here I am playing basketball, and that leg is my strongest leg. That's the leg I jump off of.
You are listening to Westward on the Dan Patrick Podcast Network. We'll be right back.
Now, you come out of New Mexico, and as you just shared with us, you became a very proficient scorer and an all-around player. And you get drafted in the third round. Back in that period, that wasn't necessarily a disgrace being drafted in the third round, but how did you feel about going in the third round?
I was at the park on the day of the draft. I wasn't paying any attention to it, and I figured if I got drafted, I'd end up on a team back east, Chicago, New York, New Jersey, somewhere like that. So, as you said, I was a 64th player picked in the third round, and back in those days, they used to have seven rounds. So, after, like, the second round, because those are probably your best players that they figure have the best chance of making the pros, people would and I heard this is true, talking to a lot of coaches at that time. After like the middle of the second round, they would take darts and throw them at the board. And whoever the dart landed by the next day, that's who they would draft. But Jerry West was one of these guys that did due diligence and did his homework. And he had scouted me. There was a player on my team in college named Marvin Johnson. And Marv was a flat-out scorer. And Jerry, we used to come down because Norm Ellen, Jerry liked to play golf. So Norm was a golfer, my coach. So Norm would invite him to games because they had a really nice golf course in Albuquerque. So Jerry would come down. So he came down three or four times. And I know he wasn't looking at me. He was there looking at Mar. But I said to myself, you know what? If he's here, I'm going to have some of my best games. And every time he came down, I had a good game. So when the draft came, I'm at the park and just playing basketball. And my cousins now came running to the park. Michael, you got drafted by the Lakers. Third round. I was like, y'all quit messing with me, man. No, you got drafted by the Lakers, so you got to come home. So I go home and find out that it's true. And that's when the next day I got a call from Jerry West and the Lakers talking about I had been drafted by the Lakers. And they give you all the information when to go to training camp and so forth. And you know, as a basketball player at that time and at any time, I think, all you're looking for is opportunity. And, you know, God blessed me with the opportunity to at least try to make a basket NBA team, and I wasn't going to let that pass me up.
At the time you came into the league, the Lakers were owned by Jack Kent Cook. Did you get an opportunity to interact with him? And if you did, what's the difference between Jack Kent Cook as the owner and the guy that replaced him, Jerry Buss?
Jack Kent Cook was, in a sense, a true owner, and he wasn't a hands-on. He was there only in name and money. You know, he knew he owned the team. So I met Mr. Cook probably about three times, and it was always at a Laker function, a meet and greet. When you first get drafted and people on the team, you all go to a restaurant or they had some at the forum and he would be there. But he wasn't a very visible owner. I, like I said, only met him three times. I don't know about Kareem and Jamal Wilkes and some of the other guys. But he wasn't that owner that was going to be present a lot. And that, you know, again, when you're a businessman and the Lakers are just a side, not necessarily a side piece to you, but that wasn't his main priority as far as his business aspect financially. He had other things going on and you attend to those. And the difference is when Dr. Buss was the best owner I've ever played for. And Dr. Buss was hands-on, was always there. He wanted to take the Lakers and the NBA to another level, and he did that by drafting Magic Johnson in 1980. And he mapped out what he wanted the Lakers to be. Not just a basketball team, but he wanted us to be entertainment, and he wanted it to be exciting. So when we got through playing, you know, you go to the movies or you go hear somebody at a concert, they entertain us. He wanted us to entertain the entertainers. And that's when he brought in the Laker girls. But Dr. Buss, I saw him almost every practice he came to at training camp. He had many, many functions where he had things over his house. He had like a core thing where it was me. Once we got into it, after we won the championship in 80, myself, Norm Nixon, Magic Johnson, Kareem, Jamal, he did something special for us, brought us over to the house and just had us core because we were the foundation. Pat Riley, I mean, when Pat became the head coach. So Dr. Buss was always doing something, always visible. He was at his office all the time at the forum. I mean, you can go up after practice or just go there on a day off, and he would be in his office, you know. And, again, he had things to do as a businessman, but he made this a priority, and that's why the Lakers have become what they've become, a franchise for the city of Los Angeles and one of the best franchises in the NBA.
Now, you also became a part of the Laker organization at a time, league-wide, there was racial issues as well as drug issues. How did you stay above the fray?
Well, you know, coming up as a young black person in California and listening in Los Angeles and listening to the trials and tribulations that my uncle went through back in down in the South, we were very fortunate and blessed. And I think at the time in the 70s, racial strife, African-Americans were making a bold step forward. I remember when we went to high school in 74, the high school I went to was close to Sierra Madre, and no blacks had went there. And we were the first class that they were allowing to go there. So I don't want to call it busing because it was many times I walked to school. But we had that opportunity to share a vision that other people, especially white people, had the chance to get a good education. And Pasadena High School is one of the top academic high schools in Pasadena. You had Muir, Blair, and several others like that. And Muir was pretty much the school for most 90% blacks went there if you lived in Pasadena. So where we lived at, when they made that change and we could go to another school, we were right there on the cusp when my family chose Pasadena, that's the school. So in there, but you know what? The Lakers have never been a racist organization. They've never been an organization. They've always been an inclusive organization.
Now, you had a front row seat to a transition in terms of the organization and the framework of the team. Kareem was already there, back end of his career, still a magnificent player. As you suggested a few minutes ago, aloof in many ways. From your vantage point, what did you think when it became necessary for this iconic figure, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, to deal with this 19-year-old ball of fire? By the name of Magic Johnson.
Kareem was never we always knew that Kareem was the focal point of our team, but Kareem wasn't that type of guy that he wanted the attention and he wanted the leadership. Kareem knew who he was, and that was one of the best things about Kareem, is that he understood who he was and what he was. And you could come bring in Magic Johnson, James Worthy, Byron Scott, A.C. Green, Bob Mackey, you can bring in whoever you want. We knew in the end that we were going to have to go to and through Kareem. So he understood that, and Kareem didn't mind Magic coming there. I think what the thing he minded is Magic's infectious about the game, his energy and enthusiasm. That was shocking to Kareem because Magic brought it to him. It wasn't about it. It was just there. Magic brought it to him. And I'll never forget that game that we played, our first exhibition game in 1980, We're down in San Diego playing the San Diego Clippers, and Kareem hit that last second shot. Magic jumped up on like we had won a championship and jumped in Kareem's arms and was hugging him and doing all that. And Kareem goes, dude, this is just exhibition. We got 82 more games to go. And Magic said, I don't care. This is how I am every day. So, you know, I think Kareem appreciated that. I think it took a little bit of a focus off of him, which Kareem didn't necessarily want a lot. But, again, Kareem was, you know, you have to understand the time he was coming through. You talk about the racial uprising and things that we went through in the 70s. You got to remember, Kareem was back there when things were being done and moved, and he was a mover and shaker with Jim Brown, Muhammad Ali, some of the best pro-black athletes that could make a stand on what we're going through right now. So Kareem was just always Kareem, but I don't think he took it personal. I don't think he took it any other way than Kareem's going to always be part of the team. And, you know, and I always appreciate him for that. Kareem's very intelligent, and he and I bonded. My birthday's on the 15th. Kareem's birthday's on the 16th. So we're fiery Aries, and we both have the love for jazz. So Kareem's father, who was a saxophone player, back in the 50s, knew Bird and Miles and Herbie Hancock. So Herbie Hancock was like his personal friend. Coleman Hawkins, people like that, that in the jazz world, jazz giants, Kareem knew them, and he's the one that turned me on more and more. I had always liked jazz, but he was like, Coop, you got to listen to this song, listen to that. So we bonded in a special way, and to this day, we're still friends. I think I talked to him more than anybody else because we probably age-wise were right there. But you know what? Kareem did have no problem with Magic coming in there and taking over and leading us to the championship we did, because we couldn't have won. Me, myself, Magic, and Kareem are the only three Lakers that have won all five of our championships in the 80s.
I've heard from different players that I know that nobody talked more trash than Larry Bird, with the exception of maybe Michael. Jordan, but what was that interaction like? Were you spitting back at him a lot of times or just staying in his ass?
You know what? I didn't get caught up into a lot. I mean, I've talked my share of shit talking. Let's just put it out there. I did my share of that. But I think the key with Larry is you wasn't going to disrupt his game verbally. You had to disrupt his game physically and technically, because Larry's a very technical player. There were points on the floor that he wanted to get to. And I think he thought the same. He only said one thing to me one time, and it was in 1984 when they beat us in the championship series. We were coming down. We had just scored, and we went up by like five. And I'm like, okay, I got you. I got you, Larry. I'm up in you, man. Let's go. He goes, man, I'm getting ready to wear you out. So I'm like, okay, now I'm really getting down to my defensive stance. So Robert Parrish comes down to set a pick on him from the baseline. And I follow the pick. Parrish doesn't pick me. And as Larry catches the ball at the elbow by the free throw line, he goes up. I said, yeah, I'm going to block this shit. I got this one. He goes up. Kareem took a step forward, too, take away the shot. And I don't know how he got that pass to Robert Parrish, because it was almost like a pick and roll, and hit Parrish on the money. And when he scored, they went on like an 8-0 run, and they ended up beating us. And as he was going down the floor, I told you, I got you. And you know what? To me, that was very significant because he understood the little things. So he didn't spend a lot of time, because he knew that wasn't going to bother me. He didn't spend a lot of time talking to me. One thing he did say, and this was in the 1987, I believe, All-Star Game, 86 All-Star Game, in the three-point contest. And I was in that, and I was all prime because I was working on my three-point shot, so I was looking to win that. We're getting ready for our event because we were right after some other event. And Larry walks into the locker room. And these are his exact words. I don't know what you – he goes, I hope you fuckers are playing for second place because I'm winning this shit. And walked out of the locker room. And then proceeded to go on and win it.
Now, the L.A. Clippers came to this city in 1984. Laughing stock for till recently, the last 7-8 years. What did you think of another franchise trying to encroach on your territory?
Well, I thought it was kind of unusual because, again, we were here, the Lakers, but I understood what, at the time, Mr. Sterling wanted, and it's hard to call him Mr. Sterling, but I'll give him his respect as far as what he did, bringing the Clippers up there. But I thought it was kind of different, for the fact is that why would you bring a team up here wanting to be like the Lakers in a crucial hard times like that? And it would be hard to match up with us. I thought San Diego was the best spot for them. But, again, he saw something different. I think now this organization is definitely – I think Mr. Ballmer is going to take it to a whole nother level. I was very surprised that they did not get an opportunity to play the Lakers for the Western Conference Finals. But as things go, hopefully they'll make a rebuild. But, again, they can be here, but they'll always be second fiddle to the Lakers because this is Laker territory, baby, Laker Nation.
You say that I have to respect. Now, as we begin to wrap this up, what are your recollections of the era that came behind you? And that would be Kobe and Shaq.
Well, you got to remember before that, in the 90s, it was difficult. You had Nick Van Exel, Eddie Jones, Elden Campbell. It was tough for them to get going. I think Dale Harris was a coach and was trying to re-energize what we had established in the 80s. And through the course of every generation, you're not going to be like the generation before you. So that's what the Lakers were trying to find. They were trying to find their identity. And lo and behold, Jerry West, and I was an assistant coach with the Lakers, and they said, you know what, we're bringing this young man named in, Kobe Bryant, out of Philadelphia, and we're going to work him out. And I was 40 years old at the time, 41, and they said, Coop, listen, we want you to put your workout stuff on and give him a good workout. So I'm like, okay, well, I mean, where's he from? He says, well, he's 17 years old, he's out of high school. I'm like, what? Oh, okay, come on, let's go. So we get to the gym and we go there, and you know what? That's when I knew the Lakers was about to turn the corner, because playing and working out against Kobe Bryant at an early age, this young man was physically strong. He had the attention to detail that a veteran has after 8 or 9 years in the league, knowing where to get to on his spots. I had to do some things in the low post with him. I had to make it difficult for him to come off a pick and roll.
Did you develop a rapport with him over the years?
Kobe and I were friends. No, because, you know, I went overseas to play. Then I had started coaching with the women's, the WNBA. So, I mean, when we saw each other, very respectful to one another, hug, do the whole handshake, you know, how your family, this, that. So it was only like that. I didn't get a chance to really know Kobe deep. Again, like I said, anytime you come through the Laker organization and you're here for longer than 5 years, you're part of the fraternity. And he's like, you know, it's a brother that we sorely, sorely miss. But the things that he did, he and Shaq did, man, set the Lakers on the path to doing great things themselves. We were the first Laker team to repeat. They were the first Laker team to three-peat. And you know what? Those are feats that will never be challenged or equal unless somebody comes and wins four in a row, and LeBron James looks like he can do that with this Laker team.
Now, we're going to close it out with our mutual acquaintance, and at some point in the near future, I hope we can all get together and break bread. Jerry West, player, general manager, human being, your assessments?
Extremely, extremely great at all three of those. Great general manager, a great man, and a great player. Jerry has all the qualities, and you know what? They only did him right as far as putting him on the logo of the NBA, because that's truly who he was. Jerry changed the game of basketball for shooting guards coming out of West Virginia. He's probably the most dangerous guard that you could ever play. And these young kids today, you may see him and you look at him now and you might look at him back then. Jerry West had the ability as a player to play any generation of basketball up until now. Jerry could play and be successful at it. Had the three-point shot before it was there, had the size to post you up, had the quickness and the deceptibility to get to the basket and pull up for that little short mid-range. As a man, Great was a leader among men. He could tell you things, a great father, a great husband, a general manager that always made the right decisions. And if you look at his path that he's traveled from us to Memphis, to Golden State, and back to the Clippers, he's been a winner as a general manager at every one of them. He's changed all them organizations. And with that, I'm saying it's a wrap. Thank you so much, man.
Okay, one more.
Hey, thank you so much, Michael. One final question. We always ask everyone this, and this is just more of a personal. Just what do you love about basketball? Something on a very personal.
What do I love about basketball? As a young person, when I messed up my knee, I fell in that coffee can. The only thing I ever wanted to do was run. Now, I could have ran track. I could have played football, but the thing I loved about basketball was running so hard that you feel that wind in your face. And you might think that that's simple, but when you can never run or you're being told not to run or whatever it is, that's something that's so simple that basketball provided me with, and that's the thing I love about basketball is the wind in my face.
That was beautiful. Thank you so much. We so appreciate it.
You are listening to Westward on the Dan Patrick Podcast Network. We'll be right back.
I wrote the book Real Men Don't Play, inspired by the lives and examples of people like the guests we have on our show today, Sam, the face of boxing, Watson. The Battle of L.A. is the history as it relates to the evolution of basketball in Los Angeles. You're a native of Memphis, Tennessee originally, correct?
Yeah, I came as an early age, 3-4 Okay.
And as we sit here right now, people around the world know you for your exploits in the boxing field. In studio with Sam, the face of boxing, Watson, originally from Memphis, Tennessee, but you grew up in South Central Los Angeles. What was it like coming up in this city of angels?
Well, it was, to me, it was a great life. It was, we didn't have that much money, but we enjoyed every day playing baseball and basketball and football. Basketball was the least, but baseball and football every day we played. Living on Normandy and, We lived on 67th and Main over in South Central, and it was great.
So when did you start going into business? How old were you when you first started your business career?
When I was 8 years old, I had a job dipping ice cream at the corner. Didn't make no money, but it was fun doing it. Serving ice cream to little kid, all my little kid friends. So then I started selling newspapers, Florence and San Pedro. I sold newspapers for a long time, Shine Shoes over there. And push baskets at Better Foods store. Better Foods is a store like Ralph's. Mm-hmm. And I would push the old ladies' baskets and for free, and they would always tip me. They'd always give me a tip for helping them with the baskets.
So could you share with us the story of how you started selling tickets?
I didn't want to do it because all my friends that were doing it was on drugs, and I wasn't on drugs. So, they did their way. They didn't keep the money. They had a lot of money, but they didn't make it. They made the money, but they didn't do nothing with it but mess it off on drugs. And I never was on drugs, so I had a little action going on. I made a little money. I remember one day at the Fabulous Farm, Magic Johnson was on Top of the World. And I had like 10 tickets in my hand, and I was stuck with them because it was almost time for the game to come on, Lakers. And then I wished and prayed for somebody to come buy all these tickets. And a limousine pulled up. I looked at the limousine when it first pulled up. It was about 12 of us out there. And he pulled up and looked at everybody, pointed at me and said, come here. I went to the car. He said, what you got? I said, I got 10 tickets. He said, I want all of them. He bought all 10 tickets for not too much, but more money than I should have been getting because the tickets were upstairs. And he drove off. When he drove off, he almost got out of the parking lot. And he came back, and I told all those dudes that was with me, I'm not giving no money back. So y'all can tell them that whatever you want to tell them, I'm not giving them. He came back and he said, "Come here, I want to talk to you." And then he was a rich guy.
You almost said gangster.
Yeah, he was like a gangster. He was Jack Gordon. Jack Gordon was one of my best. He became one of my best friends ever. But he showed me that how to make money with the ticket business. Jack Gordon. He passed away. He married Latoya Jackson. He was he had this place called the Circus Maxima on La Cienega and Sunset. But he was a big time. I didn't believe him at first. It was like I didn't believe nothing he was saying. But I went over his house. We became best friends, and he just passed away of cancer. But that was my man.
The Battle of L.A. ensued in 1959 when the then Minneapolis Lakers moved to Los Angeles. You was 5 years old, and they had as the core of the team the great Elgin Baylor, Hall of Famer, and a gentleman who will be in studio a little later this morning with us, the legend, Jerry West. At what point did you get an opportunity to see Elgin and Jerry West play in person?
Let me just say it like this right here. When I was young, it was all about baseball and football. All about it. When basketball came in, our neighborhood didn't even care about basketball. We cared about football and baseball.
South LA.
So when we heard about Jerry West, when I first heard about Jerry West and Wilt Chamberlain, those are my favorite guys. I mean, Elgin Baylor was great too, all of them. But Jerry West was a pure shooter, and I was young, still getting him a groove. We still didn't get into it that much, but we knew that the Lakers was going to make some noise. I just loved the way he shot the ball, the way he carried himself, and the way how cool he was. And it was amazing. I met him one time, so it was amazing.
So what about 1971-72? 33 games in a row. World Championship. What are your recollections of that period in time?
That's when I met the great Flynn Robinson. See, Flynn Robinson was a player on the team. He wasn't a star player. Matter of fact, Chick Hearns called him instant scorer everywhere he went because he could score real good. And I went there, I met Flynn Robinson, and that was like the greatest professional basketball player I knew. I didn't know Jerry West. I didn't know Wilt Chamberlain. I didn't know none of them, but I knew Flynn Robinson. And we became best friends for a long time.
Speaking of Flynn Robinson, over the years, your relationship with him blossomed into something very intimate. You guys were really tight friends. Is that correct?
Yeah, he was an older guy, and he was a nice guy. He was trying to beat the drugs. See, the drugs had everybody messed up in those days. Drugs were not good for nobody, and if you messed with it a little bit, you couldn't take it. And he was just like that. He off and on, he couldn't stop. And I kept, this is after basketball. When he was playing basketball, I'm sure he was great. But after that, he came to church with me. A member of my church over on 80th and Main.
What's the name of that church?
St. John Powerhouse.
Powerhouse.
So he came to church with me, and it kept him, and he was a great man after that. I mean, around that time, he was doing good. He still had a little money from the NBA, so he was cool. He was a Flynn Robinson.
So, as his health deteriorated, you put together a couple of events for him. One of them was at a place called The Cork on the west side. Under the ownership of Seth Cartwright.
Oh, yeah, you remember Seth.
Big Seth Cartwright. So you had an event there to celebrate his life while he was yet alive.
Right.
Who were some of the people who showed up at that event that night?
Well, we just had all my people. You know, Jerry Chambers would go everywhere. So Jerry mm-hmm. Chambers was there from the
former Laker
player. Yeah. Norm Nixon came through. Mm-hmm. Michael Cooper came through. I mean, it was a lot of people came through.
Wasn't Bill Sharman there?
That's right. Sure was. Bill Sharman was there. That was amazing too.
For the uninitiated, Bill Sharman is one of the few people that are in the Hall of Fame as a coach. And a player.
Wow. I didn't know that.
And a player.
Wow.
Bill Sharman could ball.
Wow.
And from what I understand, he did a pretty nice little jig out there that night. Mm-hmm. Had a good time.
Yeah, he had a great time.
And the only person that wasn't there was Jerry. Jerry couldn't make it that night, and he was forlorn about not being there that night. And then eventually, Flynn passed away from cancer.
Yeah.
And you put together a memorial service for him at Powerhouse Church of God in Christ.
That was one of the best things that I ever done, because Flynn had a lot of people and they all wanted to come see Flynn, but it spread out everywhere. So we got his family from Las Vegas, his family from L.A., and we had a big old memorial at my church on 80th and Maine.
Right.
And the one person that we all wanted there was Jerry West. And Jerry, Bobby, you talked to Jerry, and Jerry said he would come. He told you he would come from the beginning, and he came. I'm talking about Jerry West. And 300 black people balled up in a church.
The seats about 150.
Nobody could believe. When I call you and Jerry that car, I said, y'all, where y'all at?
How many times you call you?
I said, we got to start a funeral. We had a night funeral for Flynn Robinson. It was different. It wasn't, wasn't a daytime funeral. My preacher said we can have the church that night, and that's what we did, a night funeral. The whole place, nobody could believe that there was nowhere to park at all. I went next door and paid the man $20 so I can get Jerry West Mercedes-Benz up in that ghetto right next door. He said, for real? I said, yeah, I got to do this. He let me do it, gave me a little 20. 5 minutes later, you and Jerry West came around that corner. I said, Jerry, we got to go. We waiting. He said, oh, I'm here now. Let's go. We took him inside. That was
no, hold it. You had done been overheard by some of the church members saying that Jerry was en route.
Yeah.
And so by the time we got there,
right,
half the church was outside.
Yeah. Well, nobody could believe that Jerry West was really a man of, to say he was coming, and you always can make an excuse and say you couldn't make it, you had to catch a flight, you had to do this, you had to go there, your kid got sick. He said he was coming, and that meant more than anything to me. When he came, it was like a funeral, Flynn Robinson's best friend, because Flynn Robinson had, Oscar Robinson, he loved Oscar Robinson. And he loved Flint. He loved Jerry West. But Oscar was way out of country, way out where he lived. But Jerry said, if I'm in the city, I'll be there. And Jerry West came in that church. And not only did he come in the church, he said the best speech ever for a friend. It was his friend. And he said it, and he meant it all. Everything was perfect.
Well, Flynn was traded from the Milwaukee Bucks, I believe it was.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the season. And Jerry told some stories about how that went. Do you remember some of those stories?
Jerry said he had a toupee on his head or something. But Jerry said he remembered everything. Flynn loved Jerry.
Yeah.
Stock him.
The story had the whole church in stitches because as Jerry told the story, he said that there was a game, and he noticed that Flynn had more hair than he had the week before.
Yeah, one day, yeah.
And in the heat of the action now, they on a 33-game winning streak that has never been broken.
Yeah,
and he said all of a sudden, Flynn was running down the floor, and he had one hand on the ball and one hand on his head, trying to keep that toupee on his head.
Well, that was, he was they were definitely close friends. I mean, Jerry didn't see nothing wrong with having a good friend like Flynn Robinson.
Yeah. So over the years, and I do mean over the years because we're talking now over 50 years since the Lakers came to Los Angeles, and you've seen the evolution of the city and the team. What were some of your personal interactions over the years with Laker players and personnel?
Well, you know, me and Magic Johnson became very best friends. In 1979, when he came to the Lakers, I was at Motown, and I was one of the big shots at Motown them days. So we got together real soon. Barry Gordy, they asked me, do I know Magic Johnson? I said, of course I know him. I knew him already. We went out a couple of nights when he first got here. So we became very good friends. We would go by the Jackson 5 house. We would go by the Marvin Gaye's house. We would hang out, me and Isaiah Thomas and Magic and Mark Aguirre and all them guys that came to town every year with Magic's friends. We got together all the time. And Magic was my best friend from the Lakers, yeah, for sure.
Who are some of the other?
Norm Nixon, I love football.
Storm and Norm.
So it's me and his brother Snake, we'd be together all the time looking at
what'd
them.
What'd you call him?
Snake, that's what they called him.
What'd they call him, Snake?
I don't know, I guess he was Slip Snake, I don't know. But them was the good old days. Now, you asked me something earlier about the Clippers. Robin Harris was the funniest comedian in the city at that time, 45 years ago. He said the Clippers would never amount to nothing. He said that he can go down there right now and sit on the bench and put a uniform on and they'll put him in the game. I mean, he laughed so hard about the Clippers. Then he died. Now, Robin died a long time ago. But before he died.
This is the guy, baby's
Robin
kids.
Has baby kids.
We don't die, we multiply.
He told me that the Clippers will never, ever do nothing. And he's right. They get close, but they never do it. They get close. But now they got Jerry. To me, they got a shot. Now, for the first time. So I don't know why they lost them games this year. He don't know. Don't nobody know. To me, I'd go get Sam Cassell.
As the head coach.
Yeah, because I want somebody hungry to stay on. See, a hungry person will stay on your ass. A person that already got it going on, you check it out. Check life out. A person who wants to make it happen, he not going for that. Okay, every day you can do this, you can do that. No. My job, Sam Cassell's job will be online. He going hard. Ain't nobody getting no breaks on nothing. We're going to practice. We're going to do this. We're going to be on time. We're going to be there. We ain't playing around these streets. We're not going here. No excuses. You got to be, when you're going for the championship, you can't play around. Like a fight. You can't play around. If you're fighting a big fight, you got to eat right. You can't have no sex. You got to be on time. You got to be good to people.
Who said that?
When you get ready to fight, you got to be strong. Strong. Every player got to be strong. I guess for basketball too, but for boxing for sure. You got to be strong.
So, Norm Nixon played with the Clippers at one point, right?
Yeah.
Over the years, after Magic and Norm were the backcourt originally, mm-hmm. and then they traded Norm away and brought in Byron Scott. Mm-hmm. How did that affect your relationship once he was no longer a Laker?
With Nixon?
Yeah.
Me and Nixon will always be friends.
Irregardless.
Always cool because he just had that cool. He didn't care. He knew he could play. He knew he could shoot that jumper. He knew he could play that ball. So he didn't trip off that. It was no big deal for him. I wish he'd have been a Laker forever, but Clippers was just as good. As long as he was in the league, he was still getting his little money, and he was still enjoying himself doing what he was doing. And Magic went off, and Byron's a good friend of mine, too. Byron was shooting that J. Magic used to tell me all the time. Magic, when I come down court, my job is to put the ball in the hoop. He said, I would come down that court, and I see Worthy over there. Worthy, decent shooter.
James Worthy.
He wanted to slam. I look to the right, and I see Kareem ready for the skyhook. Should I throw the cap right now for the skyhook? He just hit two straight, or he just missed one, or whatever. Do I go to Byron Scott with that three-pointer, that jumper? So I don't know. Give it to Coop. Coop is okay, but he don't know. Coop was getting on. Coop was getting his own because he was a defense specialist. Or do I take it down the hole for myself? So he knew all the time when he come down court, he was looking for all five of them, or at least all four of them. He was looking.
You mentioned the captain, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yeah.
Did you have any relationship whatsoever with Kareem?
I don't think
Kareem?
Too many people did. He was real, real smart. But no, I didn't have nothing with him. He was real, real smart, UCLA graduate, down with he was a Muslim, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he was a good guy, but I didn't have no.
You didn't have a personal relationship with him? A lot of things were going on in the city in the span of time that the Lakers and the Clippers have been here. Social unrest. You were 11 years old during the Watts riots, and then in 1991, the city went back up in flames. How much did that impact the social environment in this city?
Well, 1965 was a very good year for me. Temptations.
You were 11 years old, man.
10, 11, yeah. Temptations came out with My Girl. That was my first big record, My Girl.
Your first big record? You made the song?
First big record I love. I love Temptation, My Girl, forever. That's my favorite record. And also, Martin Luther King came to Reese High School in August. Reese High School was
in 65?
Was a bad boy school. If you was bad in the city, you went to Reese or Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And Reese was right on my corner, at my corner. So we saw the ride coming. The ride was coming that day. We were selling newspapers. Me and my brother Bob, we were selling newspapers. And he said, what are we going to do? I said, we'll keep selling these papers. And we kept selling the papers to the very end. The next day, he went down to the ride. Almost went to jail, got in a lot of trouble. At 8, 9 years old, I didn't go. I never followed, never listened, followed nobody nowhere, luckily. So but that was great. To see Martin Luther King, to be that close to Martin Luther King, it was fantastic.
Let me pivot into something else, because you mentioned someone who yesterday, it was announced, has the greatest album of all time. What's going on?
It's Marvin Gaye. one of my best friends for real. When I was poor, working at Raymond Avenue Elementary School, making no money, matter of fact, $214 a month, they gave me a job at Motown. Marvin Gaye, Cuba Gooding Jr. told me first. Cuba Gooding?
From the senior. Cuba Gooding Sr.
Yeah, from what show?
Main Ingredients.
Main Ingredients.
Yeah.
I met him and said, man, I wanna be at Motown. He said, well, I'm gonna get you in there.
That was when Motown first moved to Los Angeles.
Right.
Right.
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. On Sunset.
Right.
So that blew my mind. Made me feel so good. I didn't take the job right off. Mm-hmm. I worked for the school board and kept working with the kids at Raymond Avenue, Florence, and Normandy. And I enjoyed myself so much. I loved it.
So Marvin Gaye, were you there tonight? The NBA left CBS, and Marvin did his historic rendition.
See, what happened was in those days, Marvin Gaye had a lot of celebrity basketball games. I had a celebrity basketball game to raise money at Dorsey High School, Washington High School, Jefferson High School, all the bad, so-called bad high schools. I would take a celebrity team over there, and I would take Marvin Gaye and the Jackson Five, well, Jackie Jackson from the Jacksons, and Switch, and the Silvers, and the Whispers. I would take them all over there, and we had so much fun playing basketball. That week I had talked to Marvin. I didn't go to the game, but the game, that was one of the best ever, that national anthem that he did. Nobody could do it like that. Whitney Houston, baby, but that man was bad. Marvin Gaye, he was a great man.
Could he play basketball?
No. He would try hard, and he would run fast. He'd run over you. But he couldn't stop and just shoot a jumper. He wanted layups. He wanted to just go down low and beat you up. But he was tough. I give him that. He was tough. He was a good rebounder. And he came to my celebrity games, and I couldn't believe that. When he walked in the game, that's all I had to say. Well, Marvin Gaye is here. Because now it's Marvin's here. We got a game. I didn't care if we won or lost, but he came to all them South Central schools.
The Showtime era, it was no other place any reasonable person would want to be than at the Fabulous Forum.
The Forum was lit up, man. The Forum Club after the game was more fun than anything. I mean, I was sitting there one time with this pretty girl. Jerry Buss walked to me and said, she what you, Sam? I said, yeah. He wanted her real bad. I mean, I looked at her and said, shoot, he can do more than I can. She said, what are you talking about, man? I said, I don't know, but Jerry just asked for you. Jerry Buss.
Yeah.
It was a cold move, but, you know, I always, like I said, I didn't follow none of them. They wanted me to go to the Pick Fair Forum, somehow, some big house. I didn't go there, though.
Pickford.
Yeah.
The Pickford house.
I didn't go there. Yeah. I never went where you want me to go. I stayed at the Forum and had fun.
So what did it take to get in the Forum Club back then?
You had to know somebody. You had to know me. You know, I had a hookup with the man, and the man had a hookup with me, and he got paid a little extra money that every night, every game, he got more money. I got a little bit, but he got, you know, he was a man. It was great coming to the Forum Club. Then the older Dennis, Daryl Strawberry, and all the Eric Davis, all the baseball players kept coming. Then everybody was coming. Mm-hmm. At that time, every celebrity in the world was kind of getting that Forum Club.
The Strawberry was a pretty good basketball player, wasn't he?
He was a real good Darryl basketball Strawberry. Player for Crenshaw High School. Mm-hmm. Yeah, him and Eric Davis from Fremont. Mm-hmm. They were some bad boys, too, man.
Now, Jack Nicholson.
Jack, bad man. I talked to Jack. I saw him at a game the other day. I introduced him to one of my fighters, Tank. I wanted to meet. He said, I know.
Who is Tank?
Tank is Davis, Javonte Davis.
Oh, the kid that's
got a big fight coming
gonna
up. Fight.
Who is he going to fight?
Leo Santa Cruz next month.
Where are they going to fight at, here?
I don't know if it's here, Vegas, L.A., Connecticut. I don't know. Showtime fight. It's going to be big, though.
So, over the years, you had a lot of interaction with Jack Nicholson, I'm sure.
Not a lot. Not like I should have been, but I mean, I met him a couple of times. Billy Crystal. That's who I know. Billy Crystal.
Oh, really?
See, Billy Crystal played baseball with us at Balboa Park. Balboa Park was the number one park for all the celebrities. Fonzie from Happy Days. Mm-hmm. Ralph Mouth from Happy Days. Richie Cunningham from Happy Days. Mm-hmm. Motown, the Jacksons. Jermaine, Tito, Marlon, all the Jacksons. It was a good old days. It was Bubba Knight from the Pips.
The Pips.
Everybody played ball. Tony Dancer. Mm-hmm. Tony Dancer came in and bought all the key players and messed the whole league up. Because he didn't want to lose.
Well, you was a ringer for Motown.
So we bought all my boys. I bought all my partners and we won the championship in 1995.
Is that right?
Jackson's, yeah.
Wow. Man, This is Sam Watson, the face of boxing, and an impresario that has been a dear friend of mine for over 30 years, man. And thank you for coming by and helping us, you know, get this story straight about the Battle of LA.
I don't know what I said, but I know the Clippers will be the brand new everything, because they believe, and they know they should have won this year. Mm-hmm. But sometimes when you think you're gonna win everything, that's when you don't win it.
Have you had a chance to meet the new owner yet, Steve Ballmer?
No.
He got enough money.
He went to school with Al Haymon.
Really?
Yeah, he went to school with him and Bill Gates. Al Haymon.
Oh, at Harvard.
Bill Gates and Ballmer went to school. Went to
Harvard.
Same year.
No shit. Yeah. I didn't know that. Well, you know, he got more money. He got enough money to burn up a wet dog.
Yeah, they say he got a little money. Yeah, they say. All right, brother. I'll do it anytime, Bobby. It's really good. Let's do it again. Let's have some more fun.
Okay,
thank
man.
Thank you so much. And
the great Sam Watson. Thank you for stopping by the Battle for LA.
Used to be great. I'm old now, Bobby. 66. Oh, man.
Route 66.
Route 66. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam. All right. Read it.
Westward is a production of the Dan Patrick Podcast Network, iHeartRadio, and Joy Road Entertainment in association with Workhouse Media and Sugar 23. Executive produced by Paul Anderson and Nick Pinella for Workhouse Media, and by Michael Sugar and Mike Mayo for Sugar 23. Joy Road Entertainment is P.G. Cuccieri, Jim Young, Matthew Hatchett, Tim Livingston, and I'm Bobby Glanton Smith.
Audio produced by Casey Wayland of Wayland Productions and edited by Neil Cabana.
We'd like to thank Sam Watson and Michael Cooper, and of course, the great Jerry West.